The sun shall never set on so glorious a human achievement. Let freedom reign. God bless Africa.
I am an African. I owe my being to the hills and the valleys, the mountains and the glades, the rivers, the deserts, the trees, the flowers, the seas, and the ever-changing seasons that define the face of our native land.
There is a place for all South Africans, black and white. It is a partnership.
This is now the time where we should honor the memory of Nelson Mandela to build a new, better South Africa for all our people. Now is the time.
My name is Thabo Tshabalala. I turned 30 in 2024, and on the 27th of April, it will be 30 years since the dawn of democracy. Has our country benefited from this democracy over the last 30 years? Join me as I speak to South Africans of all stripes, from the most powerful to the everyday average citizens. This is a Times Live original podcast, 30 Years of Democracy. Welcome to yet another episode of the 30 Years of Democracy podcast with myself, Thabo Tshabalala. And today I am joined by someone who defines herself as the African feminist voice on her LinkedIn. Her name is Londiwe Mtambo. She is the executive director of We Are the People. Londiwe, welcome to 30 Years of Democracy.
Thank you so much.
How are you?
Looking forward to the conversation.
I am too. How are you?
I'm good. Busy, yeah. But pretty good.
And how's the change of season coming along? You know, we are hating that direction. You can see I'm wearing a shirt. You know, it's like hectically cold, you know?
So I hate winter. So, well, hate is a strong word, but I'm not a big fan of winter. So I'm dreading it a little bit. But I like winter fashion. So yeah, at least...
Me too. The jackets, the coats, everything. You hide everything. Anyway, Londiwe, welcome to 30 Years. To start things off, I just want to get to know, where did Londiwe grow up and how was that for you?
Yeah, okay. So I am originally from Estcourt. Mm-hmm. It's a small town in KZN. It's a town that should be very industrious, but it's not because... local government,
yes.
We can list all the issues. Mm-hmm. So that's where I grew up with my parents. My parents are both civil servants.
Well, that's where it comes from. Okay.
So, both civil servants, but also both very active in terms of Ugubama shop steward, where they worked and all of that. Yeah. My dad, at some point, is in the provincial leadership of SATU.
SATU, yes.
So he's a principal now.
Yes.
I grew up fairly engaged. Like, our home was always engaging in politics. And my dad...
Well, you had the news all the time on
your
household. Yes,
the news. Every day we wake up, kudlala ezanamuhla on Ukhozi FM. And, you go to school, you come back, the news is playing. Mm. So it was that kind of household.
Yeah.
But I think also my parents were very... clear that around injustice and inequality, and they never hid those things from us, and so we were always engaged, in different kinds of.
And every time someone comes on this podcast, I always ask what era that was, so that you get an understanding of actually where the country was at that time.
Yeah. So one of my first memories around democracy as a thing for me is 2004. I must have been 10.
Wow, yeah. That was 10 years into democracy, by the way.
10 years into democracy, right? And so it was a big moment for this country. Mm-hmm. And I remember the sort of tracking of, you know, 10 years into the democratic dispensation. This is what we've done. This is how
a lot of awareness there back then, a lot more than we're seeing now. Yeah.
So, but it was also a big conversation around how much better people's lives are compared to apartheid, right? And so I listened to, because, you know, it was on all the time, news,
yeah.
I listened to all the sonars. I mean, that particular sonar, I Thabo listened Mbeki, to, all the speeches.
And I think it was an election year, by the way, 2004. Yes.
And so that was a big politics year.
Yeah.
And that's one of my first memories around democracy in this country.
And were you explained to that our country comes from this past, or is it something that you actually just figured out? Because I can imagine in a household where current affairs is like a big thing, probably your parents sat you down to say, we come from this history.
Yeah. So, I mean, definitely my parents sat me down, but of course at school and stuff, you learn about apartheid. But I think what made me very much aware of apartheid is my father's stories, because my dad lived on a farm, and my grandfather was a farm worker, and so my dad tells some horrific stories about living on the farm, and working in a plaza, and how difficult it was for him to get an education, and how education. So if his dad was sick, so if my grandfather was sick, my dad or his brothers would have to go and take over the work on the farm.
And how many brothers did you have?
Oh, I mean, my parents, my dad's siblings, there's eight. There was eight of them.
It's a lot. Yeah.
So, and there was one girl.
Okay.
And so their priority as the family
yeah.
was getting the girl to school.
Okay.
So she was the one who had shoes. She was the one, the rest of them didn't.
Yes.
She was the one who went to school every day without fail.
Mm.
Whereas they had to go to school, work on the farm. If their father was unable to work or there was extra work, they would have to
do the work. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's the kind of context my dad grows up in. But I mean, we're also from KZN, fairly violent.
I was about to go into that to say 93. I mean, we know the Inkatha and the ANC back in the day.
Yeah. I mean, I think even before that, as the anti-apartheid movement was growing across the country, there was obviously propaganda. And so my dad tells a story of when the liberation movement, that the stories were spreading in their communities.
What do they call it? Stratcom.
Yes,
Stratcom, yeah.
We've been through too much.
We've been through a lot. Yeah.
But when the narrative of the anti-apartheid movement was growing.
Yes.
And of course, I mean, the anti-apartheid movement is built in our homes, right? And so it's growing. There was a very clear propaganda from the white government, but also from Inkatha in KZN to say,
disregard
this thing.
Because
this
also
thing
this
is here to kill your children.
This conspiracy as well going on, which Inkatha was fueling, like literally kind of helping. You know, I don't want to make allegations here and say Guti, it's true or not, but I will label it as a conspiracy to say Guti, there was that thing of Inkatha helping the government and all of that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, call it what you will, but there was a very clear messaging that wasn't necessarily anti-apartheid.
And this was feeding into the news and you see
but
this.
It was also feeding into the communities, right? Mm-hmm. Like to say that this anti-apartheid movement is going to kill your children is a very specific thing to say to black parents who are parents to people who are part of the struggle, right? That's a very clear thing to say.
Shift
them away to make sure that they shift away from the
from
movement.
This thing of saying, we must end apartheid and all of that. Wow, listen, what a way to put it. And then your time in school, how was that? I mean, you are probably, I don't know how old you are, by the way, but you are probably one of the first generations, you know, to go to a multiracial school. I must say.
So I'm a born free.
Okay.
I'm 30. I'm the same age as the democracy.
We're the same age, you know.
So I am your quintessential Dintswalo. That's who I am. Because apartheid is a structural problem, well into our democracy, theoretically, I could have gone to any school that I wanted to go to, but practically and structurally, I could only go to a government school. I went to what was historically an Indian school.
Huh. At least you didn't go to the war school I had to go to the war school.
Sorry, I wouldn't have survived.
And why is that?
Because I was always very opinionated. Yeah. And I knew when things were wrong. If we're not being treated equally, I would say we're not being treated equally. And so, if the teachers are still there at my high school when I was around, they'll tell you stories. I mobilized the class to boycott a test because we weren't being taught the same.
Yes.
You can't set the test for the same date for all of us when you've been teaching this class, which happens to be majority Indian. Mm. You've been teaching them for 2 weeks extra than you've been teaching us, right? So you've been teaching them for 4 weeks. Mm. You've been teaching us for 2 weeks, but you want to test us on the same material.
And did you end up winning? Kind of.
Yes.
The mobilization. Yes, was the test cancelled?
The test wasn't cancelled. We didn't write it, and we weren't penalized for not writing it.
Okay.
We were just asked to write it at a different time, and that gave us time to go through the entire curriculum that was going to be tested.
Yeah.
But also for me, it was a matter of. One, people were being treated differently.
Mm.
And clearly, to me at least, it seemed that it was based on race.
Mm.
We all know the history between black and Indian people that is often a racist history.
Often is. Still is, till this day.
Yeah, till this day, right? And so I was very clear that, no, we're actually being treated differently and it's based on race. And if we're going to do anything here, we must do it in a just way. If I fail the test because I didn't study, or I, for whatever reason, I fail sharp. But if you don't teach me,
how am I going to pass? How am I going to learn this thing when I get home if you didn't teach me at school already?
Yeah.
And so, was there that underlying? Because my experience in high school was horrible. Primary school as well, because. You only realize it in your old age. There was underlying racism happening amongst the teachers. Mm-hmm. Was that the same for you in that Indian school? You know, yes, the test is just one example, but is it something that literally it was just a lot for you?
Yes and no.
Okay.
I mean, I think I must also acknowledge my positionality that I was... asking people to boycott the test, but I was never going to fail that test. I was one of the top students.
Yeah, top students.
Your typical sort of top student.
Top student. So then, if she doesn't write, then we're all not going to write. Definitely going to fail.
And I remember there were people who because we had to sign a letter to say that we're not going to write the test.
So did you like go and get signatures?
Yes.
And how many signatures did you get?
My whole class, except for two people,
okay.
who one of them failed the test. I said...
Could have signed.
And then they wanted to rewrite with us. I said, no. You decided to do the test with the...
And the teacher's perception of you doing that? I mean, yay, seeing a black woman or black girl standing up for something that she knows is right. How did they react to that?
So, I mean, it wasn't the first time. That wasn't the first incident. Yes. That incident happens in, like, matric. So they've had a solid 5 years with
me. To see this one.
And I was... Yeah, I was just always very outspoken, very opinionated. And I would share with... And again, I must mention my parents because they created an environment where I could be vocal. And so my dad, and I speak about my dad particularly because my mom would sometimes be like, just go to school, dude.
Don't get involved in these things.
But then she was like, what we call a shosho.
Yes, shosho.
Yo, my mother was a soldier, man. Yeah. But she would often say to me, just go to school, stay
out of this trouble.
Whereas my dad would ask me, why? Why are you doing this? Why do you think that it's unfair? Mm. What about it is unfair? Mm. Explain to me. And I would like. And so by the time I would get to school and something is happening that I don't feel should be happening, I'm able to articulate, okay, lo ku go wrong because of ABCD. And I'm not going to do this because of ABCD. I was, the teachers thought I was a bit rebellious. Yeah. Some teachers obviously supported me and supported. And I mean, obviously I had friends and people who...
probably you're also, you know, I don't know what they used to call it in high school, SRCL, SRC.
I wasn't because I had
because of that history.
Well, I'd done far too much.
They were rebellious.
They were like, no, thank you. And, writing analysis.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's high school, and I matriculated
in 2012, I guess. Yes. And then I guess this is where you realize, which I need to go study political science because... Because it sounds as though you're...
I studied political science by pure...
luck.
Yeah.
And
I was studying law.
Oh.
I wanted to study law.
Okay.
I left my family home to study law.
Okay.
To become a lawyer, which I didn't become.
You wanted to, I guess, okay, now it makes sense. You wanted to protect people, give people justice. Mm-hmm. I guess that's where the... And then where did the change come from? Was it too hard?
So I wanted to be... Yeah. I wanted to be a social justice lawyer.
Yeah.
But I went to Rhodes University.
Yeah.
Rhodes University... still produces Rhodes University produces corporate lawyers and and I mean, I'm sure there are some people who are civil rights lawyers or social justice lawyers who are from Rhodes University. I'm sure that that's true. But I really felt that the treatment, the law faculty at Rhodes University is not transformed. And I think that is the case till this day. I'm not sure. I left Rhodes a while ago, so I'm not sure. But it's very much, when I was there, it was very much untransformed. It was, you know, largely white, very male dominated, even though by the time I left, the dean was a woman.
It was hard.
You know, I can tell many, many stories about her, but she'll probably sue me. So let's not do that. So I just felt that the faculty did not allow me to become the thing that I wanted to become, and whereas the politics department did.
I mean, there's many people from Rhodes who I know studied politics. Yeah. I think even people in this building who are like political reporters, they went to Rhodes. Many of the colleagues I have actually went to Rhodes. And how was your time there? Because we all know the stories that came out of Rhodes, man, especially 2012 onwards, it was insane.
So look, Rhodes University is a historically white institution. We know this. It was never built for black people to go there, honestly.
Wow, that's a
powerful honestly
thing
speaking,
to say.
It was never built for black people to go there. But we are
You know, and majority of the people, students at Rhodes are black.
Yes, of course. I mean, it must reflect the demographics of the country.
Of the country, yes, at the end of the day.
That's exactly what it reflects. And so I get to the university. Black students have been there for a while
now.
You know, we're well into the democratic dispensation. But one of the first things I experience when we get there... So, mind you, I had very limited experience with white people. Very limited.
Like you are so used to, you know, I guess Indians and...
Indian people, colored people.
Colored people, black people.
White people here and there. But my experience with white people was very limited. And so I didn't know... I didn't know how audacious the racism was.
Yeah.
I just genuinely didn't know.
And it slaps differently when it hits you. Yeah? Of course, with me, it's the same. When it happened to me for the first time, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. So at Rhodes, there's a thing that they do in O Week.
Yes.
That is a form of like getting you into the spirit of being a rodent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we do a very weird "my blood is purple" thing. We're all purple people.
Yes.
And I didn't realize that that was about moving us away from seeing color. Mm,
from seeing color.
From seeing the structural stuff. From seeing the differential treatment.
Mm.
Because we're all purple people, right?
We're taught that when you get into the institution.
When you there are no gates, gate roads. So
I've never been, by the way.
We don't have gates.
It's not like Wits University. No, it's like security.
It's part of the community, which is part of their thing, right? Wow. It's that they are part of the community. So when you get into roads, the idea is that once you're here, we are all these brilliant
purple South Africans. Yeah.
Right? Okay, fine. First year.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, I'm passing fairly well, but it's no longer my A's from high school.
But it's always like that, though, you know, in varsity.
But it's fine. You know, I'm doing well. I'm doing okay. Partying. Oh, my God. The parties, you know.
I mean, we have to at the end of the day. We born freeze.
Hey, guys, you know, so I'm like having a fairly full experience of the university. And of the town. We go home for the first holiday. We go home. When we come back, I'm like, so obviously we're all telling stories. Oh my God, I went.
I did this. I did that for the holidays.
Mm. All the black kids were like, oh, I went to my granny's house. My granny said we must take down the curtains.
All of us went home. Yeah, right? You know.
And all the white kids are telling stories about going to London. Like, that holiday was 2 weeks. When did you go to London?
Yeah. I hear you. Yeah.
You know? So you like, oh, okay, sure, damn, okay. There's also like some fairly middle class black people there. So they're also like.
There was a friend
of mine at the time who went to Italy. I said, you went to Italy? Like, the country. So you start to slowly see the differences between people as you engage and live with people, right?
And is that because of in high school and primary school, we are so contained with people who are similar to us? I don't know if I'm making sense, who come from a fairly similar background.
Yeah.
But when you get to a university,
everyone is there.
It's a different...
Everyone is there, right?
Yeah.
But I just was like, okay.
Mm.
You know, I guess you have the ability to go to Italy. I went to escort there to my mother's house.
The curtains are not. Yeah.
And my granny on my dad's side, she used to plant potatoes. Boy, when it's harvest season, everybody is there.
One thing I love about KZN, man. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they. You know? Yeah. So, yeah, you sort of slowly start to
see the difference in this world. This starts in the world,
You also, so then I was, because I was studying law, law was baggerishing the black children. Hey, like it was dealing with us.
Mm.
June comes around, half the class is gone.
Mm.
We started off with about 600 people. There are now 300 people there. Majority of the black students have been excluded out of this class. Majority of the white students have remained, right?
Mm.
And so I'm like, okay. Mm. Maybe it's just because majority of the students were black.
Yes, were black, yeah.
Half. You know, it's not racism. Yeah. No. It's just the thing that's happening. But I'm like, so I then start asking people, what's difficult about law? What's baggerishing us? What's the thing that's making us
like everyone being excluded from this module or this subject?
And then I realized that the black students who are there, majority of them, okay, let me put it this way. It's not all of them who went to private schools or to Model C schools, right? Yeah. A lot of them, much like myself, went to public school.
Schools. Yeah.
A lot of them went to public school in the rural areas, in the townships.
Yes. because they define us as the semi-private. I don't know if you've heard that conversation before. That's because I went to a water school. It's still a public school. Yes. But however, it is kind of semi-private. And yeah, anyway, yeah.
But the problem was a language problem.
Oh.
Not only is my English limited, but law English is a very specific
yeah,
English,
yeah.
And so there was no bridging course or thing between my high school and doing law.
Doing law, yeah.
And so we brought that up and...
You try it again.
Yeah, to
you
be
try
like,
it again. Yeah,
and I think I did that in second year. I didn't.
Yes,
think in first
year. Yeah,
because I think in first year I was just so confused by.
I guess you were still like adjusting to the whole thing.
Adjusting, but I was also just confused.
Why is he failing?
Something is wrong.
Yeah,
not even just about school.
Yeah,
I just felt like something is wrong here
in this institution or that specific course
in the institution. I was like, something's wrong here. But I can't, and I couldn't
and
place
is this,
my... And
is this before Rhodes must fall?
Yes,
or,
this is before.
Before, yeah.
And so I couldn't place my finger on it because I was a purple person, right?
Mm-hmm.
So my lens of looking at the university was through the purple and
the
equality
purple, yes.
And...
What you were taught
we
in
possibly,
O Week. Remember, they taught you that.
Yeah. We can't possibly be unjust, right?
Yeah.
We're also a liberal arts university, that kind of thing. And so my lens was weird. My lens was wrong. And so then when I looked at it with my personal experience lens, I said, oh, no.
Something's wrong here.
Then I could figure out what was wrong. I could figure out the structural parts of it. I could figure out the racism. I could figure out the exclusion. I could figure it all out. And so by the time Fees Must Fall rolls around...
Then we go into that now.
I have been... I mean...
It actually... Didn't it first start with Rhodes Must Fall? Please correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't it first start with Rhodes Must Fall before it actually went on to, you know, Fees Must Fall?
Let me tell...
Yeah.
I don't know. Let me
okay.
put it to you this
cool.
way. So the 2015...
Yeah.
No, let's start in 2014. Student movements across South Africa are getting its bubbling.
I remember.
Decolonialism is a big
decolonial
thing.
And that word
decolonize.
Like decolonize education.
Decolonize,
yeah. Decolonize education. Yeah.
It was a big thing. But it wasn't just a big word, it was very much a big conversation. About no man. Something is wrong.
Wrong in this institution.
And it wasn't just at Rhodes, right? Different, even UCT.
Remember, it was, I think the coastal universities really started that, for me.
Yeah.
Started that movement, and then it literally spread out across the country.
I mean, remember the historically black institutions have been having these conversations for a long time, right? And I think, I mean, there was a time where the conversations were happening at Rhodes in the 90s, of course, when the student movement was being built.
Beginning.
Or at least it was now taking shape.
Like it was
space.
Literally now big, yeah.
But you know, democracy obviously disturbs that, right? Mm-hmm. Because democracy, we assume Muguti, we are now in a democratic dispensation. And so these things are going to.
We
fall.
Must get or these things fall, or we must get these
follow.
Things, or you know, we expect because of this democracy,
And I think by the time 2014 rolls around, we're realizing, Guti, no man,
we're not
getting
anything.
The things, you know. It's still fairly difficult to get into
university.
Particular institutions,
And because of also historical debt was a big thing, because there's some students I know still paying their fees till this day.
So there was a big conversation around... decolonize. It was also about decolonizing the mind. Like the feminist movement
even,
was growing in the university.
I think you took down the statue as well.
Not you, but
I'm saying students at Rhodes literally took down Cecil Rhodes' statue. Yeah.
So the by the time the guys at Oxford are saying Rhodes must fall, and the guys at UCT are saying Rhodes must fall. Which I think that's where the statue was taken down. I'm not sure.
I thought it was Rhodes.
No. All of these things are bubbling, right? At Rhodes, we are having, we had what we called the Black Student Movement. The Black Student Movement, I joined by mistake.
Why is that?
Because, so I had, because I had been frustrated with trying to place what was wrong at the institution, I saw the Black Student Movement and I was following their social media and following their politics, right? And they were talking about decolonizing the curriculum. They were talking about translanguaging, like different things in the university system that needed to change. And they were bringing solutions to these things, right?
So I guess you got a better understanding of what this decolonizing of an institution actually is.
So they were talking also about ending outsourcing. They were talking about multiple things, right? And these are things that I agreed with. The things that they were saying, I definitely agreed with. But I hadn't, I didn't want to get involved. I was just watching it.
Did your mother's words come back to you? Just go to school, my child.
I was just like,
just go to school. Yeah.
You know, let me just follow it, see it, what's happening there. And then one day, there was a, and so there had been multiple interventions, right, from the Black Student Movement with the university. So they had been curriculum conversation where they challenged the institution around curriculum, and they, you know, there was a whole thing. What is it? Committee or task force, task team task, formed to look at the curriculum
of the school. Blah, blah.
But that spilled over, obviously, into other parts of the university, other things that we needed to look at. So I was watching this, you know, I'm like, hey, it's true, guys.
And I'm sure you're in your third, second year now?
I'm like in my second or third,
third year,
And then I, there was a protest about, so there was a protest about VAC accommodation. So at Rhodes, you had to pay for your vacation accommodation.
Accommodation, like when you schools closed.
Yeah, it must be, it's a separate payment. It's not part of your
It's not part of the rent.
Yeah, it's not part of your yearly fees.
Haibu.
Exactly.
Okay.
But now there are students who, I mean, Rhodes is quite multicultural.
Yeah.
It's quite diverse. And so there are students who are from Ghana, from university.
So who stay there.
Who have to stay because if it's a 1 week holiday,
what's the point?
They're going to spend most of the time on the road trying to get home. And then, I mean, obviously, there are students who have holiday jobs that are here in Grahamstown and so, or Makanda now. It doesn't make sense to be going home.
To be going home.
Right?
Yeah.
Rhodes also uses the raises for, in June, they use it for festival. And so in the June holiday, they use it for festival. It
becomes like a hotel.
It becomes like a hotel.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we were like, yeah, this thing is paid for the year.
But
we should be able to stay whenever,
to stay whenever you want to stay. Yeah.
You can move people around based on, okay, we're using,
we're using this block.
Robert Sobukwe. Yes. As a hotel, and you guys must go live at,
because it's not a lot of you anyway. It's recess,
So, but you know, they were refusing that, and so there was a protest about that, or there was some fight about that, and I ended up there, and I
protesting there.
I don't know.
And how did that make you feel? I mean, being in a protest situation is.
So I mean,
how did that? Was it your first protest? Like
it was my first protest, but the thing is, we said. We had a list of demands that we felt were fairly, reasonable. So we handed over the demands to the management and we dispersed, right? And so management said they would get back to us in a couple of days. And Rhodes, their management, their thing is their responsiveness. They are responsive to the students. So they'll respond in a couple of days. And so then they respond. I didn't go to the response because I thought they would agree. I honestly
you thought
just
they would agree to all of the demands. Yeah,
because I thought they were fairly reasonable.
Yeah,
and they also had solutions.
Especially the one of accommodation vacay. I mean, that one makes sense. Yeah.
Haibo.
The response?
The response says no, not a chance. But also the response is particularly classist, right? Mm. And so the response is, if I remember correctly, is about Oqala, you guys lie on your NFSAS forms and you say your parents are dead when they're not.
No, not.
Some of you are on NFSAS and you shouldn't be. The response was unwarranted, I felt. It was very anti-poor.
It attacked the poor student.
Yeah, basically, man. Like, it was just, sure.
Yo. I mean, if you bring in stuff like NFSAS and you lie and... That's an individual thing. It's not a collective thing. It's an individual problem. Why bring it up? Yeah, I know. I'm like, why are you saying that? Yeah.
And I was at the library and I see people are running.
Yeah.
I'm like, guys, what's going on? They're like, you will not believe what Dr. Mabizela said. I'm like, okay. What did he say? And then they relay the story to me and they relay the response to me. So we're going to the offices now.
The management office.
There I am.
There you are running into the midst of chaos.
Yay. Now a protest.
Yes, now a protest is breaking out. And obviously, you don't know how it's going to turn out. Yeah.
Fully in the admin building.
Hey.
Students. Yay. Protesting now. We realize that. I must leave out parts of the story.
It's fine. It's a safe space. The people who listen here are safe. They are safe people. I hear you.
Some things might be a confession to things I don't want to confess to.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
So we realize that while we're protesting in the admin building, there's a council, HOD's meeting happening in the chambers. Mm. So we go and we occupy that meeting.
Oh, no.
And so then it turns into an occupation. An occupation that lasted weeks and weeks and weeks. Sure.
Did you go to school? Was school operating or school was just operating. Everything?
Was business as usual.
Yo.
While there were students occupying
and kind of staging this process. The university continued as well?
Yeah, absolutely. But... We would obviously disrupt classes and that kind of thing. Yes. And I mean, you know, it was business as usual, but it was very much unusual.
Yes, unusual, yeah.
And then we realized, so then we asked for a Senate meeting, or there was going to be a Senate meeting anyway, that was supposed to be at the chambers. Mm. And so we said we would wait.
We'd wait, yeah.
At the chambers, they secretly moved the meeting to a different venue. Obviously, found out about that.
Someone found.
Yes, also, I mean, Grahamstown is small. And you can walk big. Everywhere. So.
We know where everyone is.
And so, but this is my first then encounter with the police.
Oh.
In that kind of situation.
Please don't say you were arrested.
I've never been arrested.
But almost, I guess.
They weren't trying to arrest us. They were trying to intimidate us. That's the police. You know, we were being locked out of the Senate meeting. But mind you, the Senate meetings generally are supposed to be open to student participation. And so...
Is this like a conversation between management and students when you go into the Senate?
No, so Senate is a management conversation. It's like the council and whatnot.
Yes, it's like, you know, I know Action SA is something called the Senate.
Similar. Like that. Yeah. But Senate is not a closed event.
Yeah, it's open.
So if you are a student at Rhodes University and you know that Senate is happening today and you want to go to Senate, you can go to Senate. Mm. There are student representatives also from the SRC in Senate, but it's not closed. Like you're not allowed to be there.
Everyone is allowed there. If you are a student of Rhodes, you're allowed.
So we're coming to Senate.
And their response?
Oh, they tried to lock us out. Mm. I mean, they set the police dogs on us.
The intimidation. Police dogs.
Oh, it was a bit rough. And I think, I mean...
That's like apartheid tactics.
So this is what I was about to say, right? So because our history is so close to us, that thing is symbolic.
Yes.
There's a symbolism when you let out dogs on Black students.
You know, I'm not saying good rubber bullets are better. Né? There's nothing better, but there's dogs. Dogs, especially there's a specific dog that I don't know if you know the dog that I'm, and I don't want to laugh about it because it traumatizes me till this day when I see
that dog.
It reminds me of what my parents went through. I don't know if it's similar to you.
Exactly. So it triggers something automatically that then does not calm the protest. It makes it worse. Because now we're upset that you are locking us out. Now we're upset that you've set the dogs on us. We managed to get inside Senate eventually. Yeah. And we stop Senate and we protest in Senate. And we speak.
Mm.
And we say, these are the things that we've asked for. These are the things that are not going well at this university. And so also now occupation has, yes, it's about the VAC accommodation thing, but it's grown into something bigger. Black student movement is growing into something.
And you guys are seeing now this thing spread across the country. What is your reaction now to say, we're not the only ones now?
But at this point it has everyone. Roads must fall, but not really. Like at this point, we're quietly doing an occupation at a random university.
I get you.
Because even when Senate was responding to us, one of the questions they asked is, what are you guys doing?
We don't understand this thing that you're doing. What do you think you're going to
achieve? This was from a black person. What do you think? Someone who was a student activist, mind them, by the way, when they were at Rhodes. But, you know.
I hope they're not around anymore.
Aye, Angas. I don't know.
Anyway, but
you know, and he's a prominent guy, so.
No, I think I know, but anyway, it's a conversation for another day.
Yeah, I mean, look. So the response, but then we start getting calls, right? We start getting calls from the news, from
now media is there. Involved
now.
Yeah,
and I then have a radio interview, and I am fuming. This university.
Was this like on a big radio station?
On Radio 2000.
Oh no.
In 702.
I think it was 702.
Or like SAFM. It's a national station that I know my dad listens to. But I've also experienced this traumatic thing.
Yeah.
And I'm fuming.
It's the anger, I guess. Yeah.
I'm articulating myself quite well for somebody who's just, you know, been through
who's dealt with some
experience
trauma,
but I then get off the phone and I'm like, oh damn, my dad, my parents are going to hear this, because I haven't told my parents anything. I haven't told my parents,
but
that I'm in occupation.
Because the parents are so involved and know what's going on in this country, they're probably aware with this is happening. Weren't they aware?
No, nothing. I then say, okay, let me call my dad, because my mom is going to shout at me. Let me call my dad. And I'm crying. Daddy, oh my God. He's like, calmly.
Yeah.
I need you to calm down and tell me exactly what has happened. I say, Daddy, I'm protesting. He says, why? So I lay down the whole thing. This is what we said. These are the solutions we brought. This is what the institution's response was. They've sent dogs on us. They've sent the police on us. Tear gas, blah, 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 blah. I explained the whole situation. He says, okay. If I'm understanding you correctly, you guys are not wrong. If I'm understanding you correctly, and I know Rhodes University well, you guys are not wrong. So you're doing the right thing. You are right to protest.
I mean, it is in the Constitution. Everyone has a right to protest.
You are right to stand up for yourself and for other students.
For other students, yeah.
But I'm like, oh, you know, Mao Zotin,
yeah.
He says, your mom is a shop steward.
She understands.
She understands. I'll talk to her and we'll call you later. Go back to
and fight.
And I like,
I think maybe you got more confident to say, we're doing this. We're going in.
You know, and then that day happened. Multiple other days happened of different things.
And then my next question, Undo, would be, was it worth fighting for looking at universities today? Was all of that worth it? Universities today, because if you notice, every start of the year, this year, unfortunately, I think we did this year. I think we did at CPUT where students went crazy.
Yes. Like, where there was a protest about access
and accommodation, I think, when does it stop? Would it ever stop?
Yeah.
Was it worth fighting for, Nina, you know?
of course it's worth it, right? Whether or not we are now, however many years later, post fees must fall, I think about 8 years.
8 years now, yeah.
Post fees must fall. Maybe fees have obviously not fallen, but of course it's worth it. I mean, I think post occupation, I think a week later, fees must fall starts, breaks out, and we take that on.
It becomes one of the biggest movements.
And fees must fall.
Since 1976, it becomes like one of the biggest of our time, to be honest. Yeah.
National movement. And I mean, you know, of course there are people who, and you know, there's analysis that says maybe it only became a thing in the public because historically white institutions were now participating. Involved. I mean, UKZN had protests every year at the beginning of the year before that, TUT as well. So I mean, of course there's a conversation to be had there about who is protesting. But I think the demographic of historically white institutions had changed so much
to
having black and poor students there that of course it happened, right? Mm. Of course it happened that way. So I'm probably based on the trauma, unlikely to repeat a kind of fees must fall with my own body.
Also,
but if I was in that moment again and again, I would do the same thing. Again and again, I would do it. I think we spoke to broader class issues, broader economic issues, broader issues around access in this country that we had not done. In the democratic dispensation. And so I would do it again and again in that moment.
In that moment.
I think as an institution, we managed to shift and push roads towards transformation quite a bit.
You did.
The departments are more transformed now than they were
before.
I can't speak for the
Universities, I guess.
Yeah, but I also can't speak for the broader experience of the university. But I do think that we changed people's lives. I do think that we changed the institution fundamentally. And so I don't regret that. I think it was worth it.
And your views now on higher education and access to it, do you think there's a change? You know, not just at Rhodes, but across the board. I mean, now we have certain colleges, Educo, I don't know if you saw that story, colleges, big colleges are being shut down. Do you think this fight will ever end?
No, I think this fight needs political leadership, clear political leadership, right? It needs, you just need people who are willing to problem solve.
Yeah.
And I don't think that Blade is willing to problem solve. He was clear during Fees Must Fall that he wasn't willing to problem solve, right? It was very clear that he wasn't willing to. And so you need political will. You need like leadership that sees the problem, is able to view it, analyze it, the structural what, and then problem solve. We need more institutions of higher learning. There are 60 million people in this country.
Half of them are young.
More institutions than less. You need more accessible institutions. We can have conversations about, I still believe in free education, by the way.
And isn't it funny how if you look at political parties, they're not using that anymore this year. If you listen to the campaigning this year, you don't hear anything about, yes, there will be free higher education. You don't hear that conversation anymore, you know?
I mean, you know,
Is it something that, okay, it's in our minds, we've forgotten about, yeah, it's there. But there was such a focus between, you know, 2015 into the 2019 elections as well, you know?
I mean, I think it's a matter of electing people who are talking about education generally in a transformative way. Because you don't just need to transform higher education, you need to transform
the entire thing.
Yonke from
basic ECD.
Because if you look at the stats, the people who make it between ECD and matric.
Matric, it's a few.
The dropout
compared
rates
to when they start in grade one. Yeah.
Right? If you look at who gets a matric and then goes to higher education, whatever higher education of your choice, the drop is ridiculous, right?
As you mentioned too, with law.
Yeah, and so some of the people, you know, we're losing children at the ages of 10, 5, 15. We're losing them along the way. So I think that for me, that's where the conversation is about education broadly. How do we transform our education system broadly? And I mean, of course, these things are interlinked, right? If you are poor and you haven't eaten for 3 days, how are you going to go to school and learn and be productive?
And what does that result in? I result in crime, or I result in other things.
Dropouts,
get involved in things
substance
that I'm
abuse.
You know what I mean? And that's why it's such a big deal. Yes. And then after Rhodes and that whole traumatic experience, where to next was it for Ulondiwe after that time? Because now it's like, you know, it's like, oh no, we're done with school. I have my master's. You know, you have everything now. It's like, okay, what now? Where do I go now?
So I mean, I got into basically my life in civil society and civil organizing started. I think about my time in student politics and as a student activist as part of my work in civil society and in civil organizing, because I think it's the same.
It kind of made sense for you to go that direction, yeah.
Yeah, and so I get some opportunities within the civil society space, and I started working.
And I mean, you worked for some big ones. I mean, Rivonia Circle, just to put it out there, is a big movement too right now. You know, We Are the People as well, you know.
I mean, I think I've gotten to do... So I think one of the things I decided early on was that I will be an active citizen. That even when I was a non-voter, even when I had decided to stop voting, I was still engaging in active citizenship in other ways.
Yes.
I had just decided that I was done with voting, which
I'm about to ask you.
Okay,
thank God.
Definitely has shifted. And so I got to engage with policymakers. I got to engage with different community activists, different spaces, man. And I, at the time, realized, or at the time, I just felt like I wasn't making enough impact. I just felt like I'm writing these policy briefs and they sit on desks and they go nowhere. And even if they go somewhere, you know, I haven't seen some of these policy suggestions implemented, you know. They're falling on a tone-deaf government. And so that was frustrating for me. And so I decided that I really wanted to do more community-based work. I really wanted to engage in democracy. I wanted to engage our democracy on a day-to-day
basis
with people.
Who live it.
Right? And so I then moved to the Rivonia Circle, where I was, you know, able to do lots of community-based work, engaging with communities, working with communities. It just solidified my thinking around the fact that people are not apathetic in this country. People are working and developing their community. They've opted out of mainstream, that's for sure. But that's an active opting out. It's
but
not
passive. That's all. It depends on you if you want to show it into mainstream.
But it's also not passive. Yeah, the kind of participation is not a passive, we're just gonna give up, whatever. It's an active choice that people are making to step out of the mainstream. To say, actually, screw you guys.
I don't need you guys.
No, it's Joyla
guys.
And so we're going to do this thing
on our own.
On our own for ourselves. Which frustrated me even further, because then it means we have two systems of government. We have people governing themselves, and then we have this government that's supposed to be governing, but they're stealing money.
Yeah, not for the people. No.
And so I just felt like, you know, there are things that government should be responsible for, and we must not run away from that. We pay taxes in order for those things to happen,
but it's not being done.
Things are not translating to the people, and so I just, you know, had many a frustrating conversation about co-governance and creating a space for government to govern with the people. Right?
And do you think the two have become so separate that now the gap every year just continues to widen and widen and widen? Because clearly government is living. I mean, they came up with the, all due respect, President Cyril Ramaphosa, but the Dintswalo concept, you know. I thought about it, and I thought about, am I a Dintswalo?
You are a Dintswalo.
But I'm not, because let's be honest.
You're not the Dintswalo he described. But you are most certain.
But I am a Dintswalo. But I also thought, what if I come from a Dintswalo? What if I'm the grandchild of Dintswalo? Yeah. That's where I think the president got it wrong.
Well, I mean, he's a bit tone deaf. I mean, he is.
That's why I'm like, it's just like, oh, gule.
It's frustrating how tone deaf this administration is. It's just abezwa. It's like they're blind to the context and the living conditions of people. And the more you have conversations with people,
and on the ground, you know, what are communities saying about our democracy and what are they saying to you when you actually on the ground speaking to them?
So a few things, right? So one, people know and understand their rights in this country. Of course, there's always need for civic education. Of course, there's always need for that.
There's always a need for that,
But generally, people know and understand their rights. Two, people have opted out of the mainstream, like I was saying earlier on. And they've actively opted out of the mainstream. They are actively saying, no, we won't do that, but we are going to do this other thing. Right, and so people are forming community development groups, co-op, community farms,
developing the community,
just engaging in democracy and participating in democracy in their communities,
and directly every single day. Yeah, not something that we watch or listen to. It's here.
But the thing that we have to, you know, engage about. I mean, obviously people are very upset about where we are in terms of democracy. And when people think democracy, they don't think theoretically. They are thinking about the tangibles, right? The better life for all, right? That kind of promise. That's what they are thinking. And if Guguti, you are still living in the same house you lived in during apartheid now. Yes, but also, so it's not just about the same house, it's about the same conditions.
Same conditions. Guti.
Your conditions materially have not changed. Some are worse.
Worse.
Right? And I hate apartheid nostalgia. I think it's a dangerous thing for us to say, hey, kwakungconwe apartheid. It's a dangerous narrative.
I interviewed
someone
on the podcast. She's old. She came up with that narrative to say apartheid was way better. Then it was.
It's a dangerous narrative. We cannot romanticize and have nostalgia for an oppressive regime, right? But it speaks volumes of what we have, what our democratic government has done. Because it is the democratic government's actions that has pushed people
to say that.
People didn't wake up and say, oh, apartheid was nice.
No.
They are being pushed further and further into poverty.
Is it that thing of saying they don't understand what's going on? They don't even get it. Do you think they will ever get it?
Amen.
Do you think they will ever understand and live in the reality that most South Africans live in?
Because of multiple reasons. But I think more importantly, crisis steals from us, right? So poverty steals from us. It steals our ability to think about and dream about better. Because you're focused in this crisis, right? You're stuck in this poverty. And so our ability, so one of the things that we did when I was at the Rivonia Circle, part of the program is to ideate about a South Africa 2.0, the South Africa of your dreams.
Of my dreams.
It is mind-blowing to watch people get an hour or 2 hours to dream. them because they don't have time outside of that to do that, right? But also it's mind-blowing that their dreams is like functioning.
It's simple things.
Water.
It's things that
they
need to
happen. They want water, they want electricity, they want basics. Street lights. I'm like, your dream is the basics. Lights. Yeah, what, comrades? No.
Forget.
You know, my dream is like, you know, my dignity not being attached to work. Like, whether I work or not, I should live a dignified life.
Dignified life. Wow.
Right? My ability to eat should not be linked to a job.
Hmm.
That's my, like, dream, you know? Mm. I know we're not going to achieve that tomorrow.
No.
But, you know, that's the thing that I dream of. I dream of that kind of society where our dignity is not attached to whether or not
you're working. Whoa. You know, our class is not defined by work. That's a powerful thing to say. And then we go into, by the way, you're also a traditional healer.
By the way,
she's also a traditional healer.
Yes.
And how has that journey been? And has it changed for you over the years, learning about spirituality compared to, you know, 2004? You know, I don't know if you believed in spirituality. I mean, you're 10 years old. I mean, did you see it?
Yeah.
Did you see it coming? Has the trends, I mean, have the trends changed? Because I feel as though in the generation now we live in, it's easy for me with this climbing, I'm at Rosie.
Yes.
But back in 2007, now was what are you talking about? You know, how's that journey been?
Yeah, I mean, look, of course, it's more accessible. Easier to talk
about. I think
about
that
now
it's
just also
part of our
mainstream
lives
away
now.
From
right? So there are more gogos,
witch hunts, and you know, grannies getting burnt in the momo because they are said to be abatagati. You know, I think it shifts our social fabric.
Yes.
And shocks our social fabric a little bit.
It does.
It also allows us to have conversations about who we are and can be, right?
Yeah.
Like, I live in a suburb, ne? I have a neighbor who is white. He was very upset that I was beating the drums. And that I was doing gogo things in my yard,
in your yard,
in my home.
Whereby you own, it's yours, it's nobody else's.
And so we had a whole situation there.
Mm.
And I realized throughout the altercation that his frustration was that I didn't belong here.
What does that mean?
So I said, where do I belong? In South Africa, in democracy, where do I, a black woman, belong? And I think he realized that he had fallen into his bigoted tropes.
Yes.
He realized that he has no... unless I'm actually disturbing his peace.
Peace. Mm. Was it a thing of, I'm just seeing this, what's going on? Is this, you know, people think, is this voodoo happening?
No.
Is this witchcraft happening?
He didn't know what
it was. Didn't know what was happening.
But he also, once I had explained what it was, he wasn't, you know, necessarily tolerant.
Mm.
He, in fact, went the intolerant route. And
so it got worse even after he explained.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, the city got involved and everything. And so me, I know English.
Oh, city.
Like,
was
it
that
whole
deep?
Thing. It was a whole thing where we had to mediate and.
Is this like recently?
Yeah.
It's not long ago.
It's like in 2022, 2021.
That's now.
It's very recent. And so we then, you know, go to the city and we have a conversation. Mm. And I then say to the city, I then point out that, well, I mean, your bylaws, because they were saying, according to their bylaws, I can't drum. I said, firstly, I'm drumming for 15 minutes in the morning and for 15 minutes in the afternoon, firstly. And also, I've compromised and said I'll only drum in the afternoon for 15 minutes.
Mm.
If it's long, it's 30 minutes.
Mm.
Ne? Which he hadn't told them in their complaint. And so they're like, oh.
So what do they think you drum?
It's not unreasonable. They're thinking I'm
drumming all the way. All the way.
Come on, guys. I point out all the sort of discrepancies in the bylaws and in And then I point out that, well, remember the suburb was never built to have Izangoma. In the township, if I lived in the township, this would not be a conversation.
It wouldn't even matter.
Because you would understand. If I lived a street or two away from my street, which is now predominantly a black area, this wouldn't be a problem at all. Having this conversation. We're having this conversation because I, a Sangoma, black woman, lives in this part.
In a white area.
Yeah.
Where...
predominantly. And so, or historically rather, because actually most
it's all because of the spatial planning. We all, it's the apartheid,
And so, then we, you know, whatever conversation, mediation happens, and I then, so the city is not able to prove to me that I've broken any laws. But he is not able to prove that I've broken any laws. And so he then says no. He then gets frustrated and he just says, but this thing doesn't belong here. And so again I say, I'm glad you've said this in the presence of other people. I want you to tell me where it belongs. We don't live in apartheid where certain things belong in the corners of the earth. Where should I go? And he couldn't answer that question. And so we've sort of lived. And then I said, okay, it's fine. Because I understand that this whole thing that you guys are doing here is unconstitutional, actually. Because I have a very clear understanding that this entire thing is unconstitutional.
Because you're not breaking any bylaws.
It's not just about breaking the bylaws. The principles of this conversation are not constitutional. And so I am happy for us to go to court. We haven't been to court. There hasn't been any complaints.
But he knows he's going
to
lose. He knows he's going to lose either way.
But what that tells me is that, and then the city was saying to me that there are multiple cases like this actually in different suburbs around Gauteng, around Joburg. But what that tells me is that ogogo nomkhulu live, obviously, we live with us in all our different communities. And they are able to participate in their culture, in their traditions, in a way that is free.
Free.
Of course, we are still limited by laws. We're still, our ability to use public rivers, for example, is a big problem for me. It's a big frustration of mine. If I had time, I would protest about it, but I don't.
Also, the slaughtering,
but there are laws that regulate that.
It becomes such a, for us in my town, it was such a problem. The police were involved. Oh, so I had a similar experience with you, what you had. It's
there
a similar
are laws
experience.
That regulate that. Yeah. Other cultures slaughter all the time. And this was part of my question with this. I'm making a noise with the drumming thing. I was like, when they do the prayers,
the speaker. The speaker so loud that you hear everything.
But it's not a disturbance. But it's also, it has been decided. There's a case, I just don't remember the name of the case, that decided what the regulations of that would be. I said, think about it in a similar way.
And what do you think the issue is there? Is it because it's education, them not learning other cultures, us not?
No, Abafuni.
What's the issue? Then why do we speak of this rainbow nation?
Abathandi.
Then clearly it doesn't exist, this rainbow nation.
One of the things we must accept about the rainbow nation, at least this is my observation and my thinking.
Yeah.
One of the things that we must accept about the rainbow nation is that for a long time, I'll say non-whites, so black people, colored people, Indian people, we were banding behind this rainbow nation with only a few with a minority from white people banding behind it.
Yeah.
That's just my observation. But the second thing is that more than the rainbow nation, so I don't think people in South Africa are just automatically intolerant of each other.
Yeah,
I think,
that's true.
I mean, there are circumstances that bring us to where
we
are.
Yeah, that's true.
I do think that people believe in a kind of unity about being South
being
African.
South African.
I think that exists.
We have those moments. Yeah, it does.
I think, unfortunately, I don't know, we have to find a way to galvanize that spirit for the positive spirit of being a South African to come through. We have to help each other. We have to work together. We have to fight together to get that out. But it's incredibly difficult in a context, in our current economic context. It's incredibly difficult in, you know, if, you know, it's just difficult. Our context makes it very difficult. But I don't think that it's unattainable. I don't think that unity in this country is unattainable. I think there are structural things that we must fix so that people are able to socially band together.
Because if the guy understood Yi Nobunkoma, I don't think he would have then complained. Do you think he would have?
But
okay. Because I'm trying to like link, you know, spirituality and this thing that we call democracy. Where will they meet? Where, like, when will we accept our differences? We are different, guys. We are different. Don't judge me because I am beating the drum. Don't judge me because I say I'm gay, or don't judge me because, like, we still have a long. Don't judge me because I'm black. If you're white, you feel me? When will we put our differences aside and just?
I don't think it's about putting differences aside. I think it's about getting to know each other better.
Like, will that ever happen?
I think it's also about trust.
There's a
major trust deficit in South Africa, whether it's between us as citizens, whether it's between us and the government. There's a major trust deficit in this country, and that's something that we must work on. That's something that we need to, you know, actively build. I don't know when we get to a better place and an ideal place. But I do think, and this is part of why I've now formed We Are the People. Part of the conversation is to say, what is it that we need to do? What's the action that needs to happen in order for us to get to the thing that we desire, to get to the thing that we deserve? And part of that is getting, so we've somehow managed to convince more people, generally. We've convinced each other to register to vote. We need to convince each other to go to the vote.
Because it's easy for me to motivate you. Go register.
Yeah, we've pushed each other.
Waking up that morning of the 29th.
We have to diarize our 29 May. You have to diarize it. One. You have to have a plan of action. It's not just about ngizovuka ngiyovota whenever I wake up and go vote. I am going to go vote at 9 a.m. I'll be at my
voting station.
I am then going to go and fetch my cousins, my brothers, uncles.
Let's go.
Take them to the voting station.
Wow.
What are you doing with the day of the 29th of May?
Not just me going
not
to
just
vote.
Ex.
Nining humming ikaya.
Are
take
you
my favorite
going
babe.
To be an independent observer? Because we are the people who must make sure that the election is free and fair, that the people show up for the election, that we, you know, the government that we get post the election, we are responsible for that. Nobody else. And so how are we going to show up on the 29th of May? I think that's incredibly important.
I think that's
a conversation we must have between now and that day daily.
Now it makes me think of what am I going to do to motivate somebody to go and vote. And just final two questions, man.
Sure.
Your stance on politics, would you ever go into, I mean, I feel like it's part of you. I think it's time for you to open up a political party and contest. Do you see yourself in the political arena of this country?
Yeah. Sure, I would definitely contest. It's just a matter of time and figuring out where exactly I would use that part of myself. I think, and this has been my experience talking to hundreds and hundreds of communities. We have so many leaders in our communities. We have so many leaders in our activist spaces that are not mainstream. In mainstream politics or in legislatures and all of that kind of thing. And I think part of the thing we must convince each other, and this is a question that I always ask community activists and you know, community builders that I engage is, why are you not on the ballot? And so one day I will ask myself that question and I'll put myself on a ballot. Mm.
And how does the question of a female president make you feel? Why do we, it bothers me that we still have a conversation. Like, when are we going to have, does it matter if the president is male or female?
Yeah,
of course it matters. Or is it time, Uguti, we need a female president as everyone is? Do we need that? Is there a difference?
We always need women leadership.
Yeah, we do.
We always need women leadership, right? I think, you know, the conversation is... I think the conversation is important, but remember, not all women are feminists. Not all women are pro-women.
Yes.
And so we don't want a female president for the sake
for
of
the
having
sake
a
of female president,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at Rwanda, for example, majority of the parliament is women, yet we all understand the context.
By the way, I found a stat the other day that there's more female MPs in South Africa than there are in the rest of the world. I found that very...
Wow. But that doesn't always translate to pro-women politics or to a feminist politics, right? So you need women who are feminist, who are pro-women, who are pro-poor, who are pro-black. Like, you need women with a particular kind of progressive politics to occupy positions of leadership. But we absolutely need women leadership across the board. I think it's important that I think that stat is important. And I think it's something to celebrate because representation is important, right? Because when my ability to see myself as an MP is important.
It's important.
Because I can see other black women doing it.
And the most people who vote are?
Women.
Female. Wow.
Women.
The
stats are clear.
It's clear. It's been women, I think, since 1994, you know. And just lastly, the next 30 years of democracy, where do you see it? You know, is there hope? I always use this thing, this word in ending off an interview. Is there hope for this democracy?
There has to be hope.
Yeah.
Because we exist.
Wow.
We exist.
Wow.
The people who are fighting for this democracy daily, there has to be hope because we exist, right? Mm. I think there are more of us.
Yes, than them. Than them.
And the us and the them, I'm making a distinction between here, is there are more progressive people and people who want to lead and build, who want better for this country.
Care about the country.
Than people who don't. The problem is that they organize and they work. We don't. Or we organize in silos.
Or we do things, you know, differently, same different space.
We have to organize with each other.
Wow.
We have to organize.
Mm.
Mobilize. We have to. Particularly when it comes to this election, because we've got an election coming up.
Mm.
We have to mobilize.
Do you think it's a defining election? Because I feel like every year it's defining.
I think this is particularly a defining election. I think our victory as the people, and I think the people must win this election, right? Our victory as the people will be in our mobilizing and our organizing and getting each other to the polls, getting each other to vote for something different.
Mm.
We don't. Just because it's better than apartheid does not mean that that's the thing that we deserve, comrades. And so we have to...
Apartheid nostalgia.
We have to get each other. We have to get each other and inspire and encourage each other to do a different thing for ourselves. Not for Amasela, for ourselves.
Okay. Mm.
We have to do a different thing. And so, Mina, that's what I'm doing.
Mm.
I am mobilizing and organizing and encouraging South Africans to not only go to the polls, but to go to the polls and do it differently.
Differently.
Vote for somebody else.
Not green,
vote
black.
Vote for something else. Vote for something else.
Yeah.
We have to vote for the change.
Mm.
We are the people who are going to make this thing happen.
Mm.
In South Africa, we live in a democratic country, guys. The only way to change government is to vote.
To vote. Mm.
It's the only way. And so are we going to use our vote as a weapon?
Mm. Are we? And then you get this narrative. Sorry, just to add in one more question. This narrative of some politicians saying it's going to be rigged or they're going to try and cheat.
No.
Like, isn't that... like demoralizing or like literally bashing the IEC and their credibility.
Outside of the IEC's credibility, I think, you know, I have many, many things to say about the IEC, but even if we take them out of this thing, right? Saying that the election is going to be rigged or is going to be like stolen is disinformation. It's active dis or misinformation. You are misinforming people so that they don't show up to the polls. That is what's happening. No one is going to rig this election, I promise. No one is going to steal this election. It's a lie. It's a lie so that the less people show up to the polls, the less
change,
to happen. Yeah. Right? So if the same exact 50 people show up to the election as 50 people showed up for the last election, we're going to have the same result. Problem. It works for the ruling party and for other major political parties when we don't show up to vote.
That's true.
It works. It's easier to get 50% of 4 million than it is to get 50% of 20 million, of 27 million. We have 27 million registered voters. Every single one of them,
Show up. They must show up. That's true.
If young people got together in this country and decided to vote for a cat, the cat would be the president.
That's powerful. Yo, Lundiwe Mdambo, I am lost for words. I guess this is why this podcast exists and this is why the podcast is here. Thank you so much for making time. I learned a lot in this discussion, and I hope whoever's listening as well has learned a lot. And guys, this notion of elections are going to be rigged, please
go to vote, comrades. Everybody go to vote.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys. And until we meet again in the next episode, this has been the 30 years of Podcast Democracy with myself, Thabo Tshabalala. Thank you guys so much.